It's a pleasure to be back here. I'm going to take a chance and tell you a story that I think I may have told you before, but I want to begin with that because I believe that it underscores the way that I believe we have to approach this year and the way we have to approach the Chumash in general. The story is told of a man whose task it is to stand outside of a minimum security prison camp in the ex-Soviet Union. Before the Soviet Union falls. And it's the job of this particular guard to make sure that when the prisoners who work in the camp and then go home to sleep outside the camp at night, when they leave, they don't take anything, any of the material that's in the camp. They don't steal anything. And at the beginning of his tenure, one particular prisoner catches his eye. This particular prisoner wheels out a wheelbarrow full of straw from the camp. The guard stops the prisoner, empties out the wheelbarrow, looks carefully, looks at the straw, finds absolutely nothing, and allows the prisoner to go. Next day, prisoner wheels out a wheelbarrow full of straw. Same tekes, stops, looks at the straw, looks, doesn't find a thing, lets the prisoner go. This happens day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out, for 30 years. 30 years, every single day this prisoner wheels out a wheelbarrow full of straw. Finally, after 30 years, the guard turns to the prisoner and says, "Listen, I'm about to retire, and I promise you that your secret is safe with me, but it's going to kill me for the rest of my life. Can you please tell me why for the last 30 years you've been stealing straw?" The prisoner looks at the guard with a glint in his eye and says, "You still don't get it, do you? For the last 30 years I've been stealing wheelbarrows." When we look at the Chumash text, part of our problem, I believe, is that we simply see the straw and don't notice the wheelbarrows. That very, very often, and I have a particular bone to pick with the way that we teach our children Chumash and often the way we learn Chumash. Simply put, we learn Medrash as Pshat. We go straight to Medrash. We don't look at the text. We don't look at what the text itself is saying. We assume that because Pshat comes from the word Pashut, that that means that it's simplistic and that there isn't anything really to see there. Let's go straight to what Chazal say. And very often, by doing that, we fail to understand either the Pshat, neither the Pshat nor the Medrash. Pshat, what's in the text, is overwhelming. And the lessons that can be learned from the study of the text itself, with the help at times of the Pashtanim, with the help of the Rashbam, for example, and other Perushim who adhere to the Pshat of the text, the messages can be overwhelming and extremely, extremely significant and important. Then we go to the Medrash. Then we should look at Medrash and try to understand what Chazal are saying beyond the text. But because we confuse the two, we fail to understand either in appropriate fashion. In addition, and this just happened to me now, we often relegate the study of Chumash text to a second tier. We go straight to other studies. I just went to the Beis Medrash on the third floor to look for a Chumash. Couldn't find one. There was no Chumash in the Beis Medrash on Bereishis. And that's because very often we have the attitude that the Chumash is the commentary that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wrote to the Talmud. Failing to understand that really it's with the Chumash that we have to begin. So today, together with you, I'd like to explore one particular issue, one particular question, from the perspective primarily of Pshat, with an attempt to understand different Pshat approaches to a critical question within the Yosef story. Now, the story of Yosef and his brothers, and this is where you have to start. Whenever you start learning Pshat, you have to start by asking the questions. There is no story within the Torah that raises more critical questions to my mind than the story of Yosef and his brothers, ranging from the philosophical to the mundane and the practical. philosophically, for example, what is the element of Bechira Chavshi that exists within the Yosef story once everything, in a sense, is predicted to Avram in Bris Vein HaSorim? What is the interplay between Bechira Chavshi and predestination in God's prescience when HaKadosh Baruch Hu reveals to man his plan ahead of time on some level? What exactly was Yaakov's mind when he sent Yosef to the brothers? Was he unaware of what was happening? Who exactly sells Yosef? The Torah is unclear as to whether the brothers actually sell him or whether or not he's sold by the Midonim or the Midyanim. It's a very, very difficult story. Questions go on and on and on. But the question that I'd like to explore with you, to my mind, I've always felt, is perhaps the most difficult question of all. And that is why, and we put it in a modern fashion, why, given the opportunity, did Yosef fail to contact his father? Why, given the opportunity, once he rises to power within Egypt, does Yosef allow his father to continue to believe that he's no longer alive, and no attempt is made on the part of Yosef to communicate with Yaakov at all? This question is, I believe, a perplexing one, and it's not a new one. Take a look, for example, if you will, at the first source on your page, and you'll find that none other than the Ramban raises this question in very clear fashion. The Ramban here is commenting actually on the encounter between Yosef and his brothers. And the Ramban asks, in a general sense, why doesn't Yosef reveal himself to his brothers? And within the context of that overall question, he goes even further. And he says, Ki yesh litmoa, thank you, Ki yesh litmoa, achar sha'omad Yosef b'mitzrayim yomim rabim v'hoya pokid v'nogid b'veis sar gadol b'mitzrayim. Now the Ramban is asking already, not from this point, when Yosef is already viceroy in Egypt. The Ramban says, already when he's in the house of Potiphar, why at that point doesn't he contact his father? Eich lo shalach k'tav echad li aviv lo gio ol nachamo k'mitzrayim karov l'chevron k'shisha yomim v'ilu haya mahalech shana ha'roi lo dia l'chod aviv. If he would have had to travel for a year, he should have traveled for a year. It's 6 days, says the Ramban. 6 days from Mitzrayim to Hebron. Travel. Do something. Send a messenger. Now, the Ramban has a particular approach to this question. And by the way, this is just one quote. Later on, in this same Ramban, he goes even further and says that Yosef would have sinned greatly if we can't explain this. Otherwise, how could he allow his father to endure such pain? The Ramban, of course, bases his approach to this question and to the question of Yosef's entire behavior concerning his brothers on one particular textual nuance, which is in the second section. And follow it with me for a second. Vayar Yosef esachov vayakirei. Right? Our setting is as follows. Yosef and the brothers are finally reunited. However, the brothers don't know it. Yosef is viceroy. Vayar Yosef esachov, vayakirem, vayisnaker aleihem. And he makes himself strange to them. He recognizes them, but he disguises himself. Vaydaber itam kashod, etc., etc. And then look at Pesukim Ches and Tes. Vayaker Yosef esachov, vehem lo hikaru. He recognizes them, they do not recognize him. Vayizkor Yosef esachalomos asher cholam lohem. Vayomer aleihem eradlem atem, etc. And Yosef remembered the dreams which he had dreamt concerning them, and he begins to torment them, to say that they are eradlem. Now, look at those psukim and tell me what's strange in the flow of those psukim. What would you expect to be different? Just push a shot. Okay, correct. Why does it mention Vayizkor Esachalomos, correct? And again repeat, and why does it again say Vayakir Yosef Esachov, Vehim Lo Hikiru, right? Why again repeat that? What else? What else, though, is strange, just in terms of what your expectation might be based on, what would you remember if you were Yosef? First time you're seeing your brothers, what would you remember? Right. Correct. Yosef's standing there. Yosef's looking at his brothers. It's the first time he's seen them since that event. Vayizkor Yosef es hamechira. Right? Yosef remembered that they threw him into a pit. What is Vayizkor Yosef es hachalomos? What does that have to do with this dramatic moment? So therefore, Rashi immediately comes along and says, and the Ramban quotes Rashi, V'yedash niskaimu sheresh tachav ulashon Rashi. Rashi says that Yosef at this particular moment looks at his brothers and says, you know what? My dreams have come true. My dreams have come true. This is an amazing realization. I saw that my brothers were going to bow down to me. My brothers are bowing down to me. That's Rashi. The Ramban says no. The Ramban says, you know, it's not that Yosef realizes his dreams have come true. It's that Yosef realizes that his dreams have not yet come true. He says, I dreamt, and look in the third paragraph before us. Ulefi dati shehadovar behefech, says the Ramban. No, I believe exactly the opposite. Ki yomar akotzov ki biros Yosef etzachot mishkatham lo zokharas hachalomos asher cholam lohem vayoda shelo niskayim echod mehem bepam hazos. He looks and he says, you know what? Neither of my dreams have come true yet. Why? Because my first dream where I dreamt of my brothers bowing down to me, sheaves of wheat, there were all of my brothers. Who's missing now? Who? Binyamin. And my second dream, not only has my brothers bowing down to me, but has who? My father and my mother, and of course that creates a problem because his mother is no longer alive, or at least this is the way he interprets it, so it'll have to be his mother's servant. But therefore, says Yosef, it's clear to me that my dreams have not yet come true, and not only that, but what now? It's my job to make them come true. That's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me those dreams, because he was not only telling me what would occur in the future, he was predicting for me what my task would be. My task is to ensure that those dreams come true. I therefore have to set about a pattern, and therefore, says the Ramban, that is why he does not reveal himself to his brothers, says the Ramban. That is why he puts them through. This is the Ramban's reason. Because one could ask, why does Yosef torment his brothers? Is it simply revenge? So the Ramban's approach, unlike others who say that he's trying to make them do tshuva, is that no, he is motivated by the dreams. He sees himself as the vehicle for God's will. He has to make those dreams come true. So he's going to manipulate events to have Binyamin come down, and then he's going to manipulate events to what? To have his parents come down as well, his father come down as well. And that is the Ramban's approach based upon these psukim, based upon Vayizkor Yosef es hachalomos. That is his motivating feature. Now, what's the problem with the Ramban's approach? The problem with the Ramban's approach is raised by a number of mefarshim, including the Baal Akedah, the Akedas Yitzchok, the 15th century scholar, Spanish scholar. He says, wait a minute. Who appoints Yosef as God? Let's assume for a moment the dreams are a form of nevuah, although a very hidden form of nevuah, as I'll explain in a moment. Who says that it's the job of the Novi to what? To make them come true. Who appoints you? Hashem granted you a nevuah, and now you do what's right. And says the Akedas Yitzchok, leave it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu who makes them to make them come true. And this certainly is a question on the Ramban's approach, and one would have to go back to the Ramban and try to struggle with the Ramban to understand who Yosef is and how he views his relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he believes that it's his job to fulfill HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. There's something very interesting about Yosef. This is not quite an aside, but it's important for us to realize. Yosef is a very complex figure. And yet Chazal will eventually refer to him as Yosef HaTzadik. What is his tzidkus? So there are a variety of potential answers. But one of the answers that I believe is critically important is to recognize, again, you have to back up from the text and see a pattern that's easily missed. There's a vast difference between Yosef's relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the relationship of his grandfather, and his great-grandfather. What's the difference? The difference is that when it comes to Yosef, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is suddenly silent. God doesn't talk to him. Hashem talks to Avram, Hashem talks to Yitzchak, Hashem talks to Yaakov. Not once does HaKadosh Baruch Hu directly appear to Yosef to tell him anything. The God who appeared to Yaakov when he's at Bethel and says to him, "Don't worry, I'm going to take care of you," does not appear to Yosef in the barn and say to him, "Don't worry, it's going to be all right." And yet, what does Yosef do? And it's amazing. Yosef continually brings HaKadosh Baruch Hu into the equation. Always. Yosef lives in a time of God's silence, and constantly sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand in everything he does. Potiphar, Nechama Leibowitz points this out beautifully. Listen to this pasuk, because again, it's so easily missed, and if you don't pay attention to it, you just don't recognize the strength. It's in Parshas Vayeshev, in the house of Potiphar. Potiphar's wife turns to him, and says to him, and attempts to seduce him. And what does Yosef say? He says, "Hein Adoni lo yodati ma baboyes. My master has left everything to me. He doesn't look over me. V'lo chatzach mimenu uma kim osach basher ad ishto." And then he goes to Babayas. He says, "Nobody's greater than me. V'lo chatzach, he hasn't held anything back except for you. V'eich e'eseh ha-ro'ah ha-gedolah ha-zos. How could I possibly do this horrible thing? V'chatasi to who?" Who would you think it should say? L'potifar. Right? It should say v'chatasi l'potifar. That's the logical extension of his arguments. Chatasi l'Hashem. Hashem. Over and again, when the butler and the baker say, "We understand you know how to interpret dreams," he says, "Hashem." When it comes to Paro, and he stands before Paro, he says, "Bilodai, Hashem ya'ane et shlom Paro." So over and again, Yosef brings HaKadosh Baruch Hu into the picture and sees, and finally, when he reveals himself to the brothers, he says to them, "Don't worry, Hashem planned all this." So Yosef sees himself as the instrument of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that might be the Ramban's explanation, that unlike others who perceive themselves simply as maybe getting messages from Hashem in dreams and visions that aren't clear, Yosef sees himself as the instrument of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that gives him the impetus to say, if Hashem granted me these dreams, then it's my task to fulfill them. So that is the approach of the Ramban. And that's an example of a classical approach to our question as to why Yosef doesn't contact his father, why he doesn't phone home. The second approach is a contemporary approach. It's an approach which is a bold and revolutionary approach. It's suggested by Rav Yoel ben Nun. Rav Yoel ben Nun is a major figure in the religious Zionist movement in Israel today. The Rav of the Kibbutz Hadati, the Hezder Kibbutz Hadati Yeshiva in Ein Surim, and a scholar of Tanakh. And Rav Yoel ben Nun says that there's a critical thing we have to realize. And that is that Yosef does not know something that you and I know as the story unfolds. And that critical fact is he does not know that his father thinks he's dead. Let's understand something. Let's put ourselves for a moment in Yosef's place. Yosef is thrown into the pit. He is sold by his brothers, and he's sold into Egypt. What would be a logical expectation of Yosef? Somebody's going to come looking for me. Huh? My father. Says Rabbi Yoel ben Nun, this 6-day journey between Hebron and Mitzrayim now cuts the other way. It's not just that Yosef could have contacted his father easily, but his father could have, what? Gone looking for him? Silence. Nobody comes looking for him. And suddenly, says Rabbi Yoel ben Nun, Yosef begins to wonder. Now, here, we'll see in a moment where Rabbi Nun will base himself on text. Here he's surmising Yosef's mind, and there is no real evidence, but let's follow his theory. His theory is that, I don't know that my father, where's my father? Starts to begin to think, and he says, you know, let's look at a pattern. He said, in every one of the patriarchal generations, one of the sons is sent away. Is it possible that somehow someone convinced my father that in this generation I'm the one to be sent away? I don't know what it means. I don't know why. My father loved me, but is it possible that that father's not looking for me? Maybe Leah, maybe the brothers, maybe even HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that I'm the carbon, in a sense. I'm the one who has to leave the home. And then he begins to question as well, my father knew or had to know of the enmity my brothers felt towards me, and yet he sent me to look for them in Shechem. Is it possible that he was somehow complicit? And all of this is based, says Rabbi Nun, on the fact that nobody's coming to look for him. Says Rabbi Nun, this explains a very difficult phenomenon in the text. Look at Pasuk entry Dalet 4. Yosef has a son. Vayikra Yosef eshem habachor Menashe. Ki noshani Elohim eskol amoli v'eskol beis ovi. You and I, Yirtz Hashem, Baruch Hashem, have children, grandchildren. We name them for people within our family because we want to underscore the connection with our family. Why does Yosef name Menashe Menashe, says the Torah? To celebrate, to recognize the severance from his family. Says Rabbi Nun, Yosef, after years of agony, comes to the conclusion that this is his role. That his role is to somehow be the member of the family who is outside the family, who is committed to retaining the traditions of the family. He will not give that up. He will maintain them, but from a distance. And because of these fears and because of these concerns, he does not reach out to his father, because he says, this is what my father decided. When does Yosef finally, says Rabbi Nun, reveal himself to his father, to his brothers? After Yehuda expresses remorse and talks about and defends Binyamin. So we all assume that Yosef is reacting to Yehuda's tshuva vis-a-vis Binyamin. Says Rabbi Nun, there's another sentence in Yehuda's arguments that may well have been the catalyst. Look at sentence section 5. This is Yehuda speaking at the beginning of Parshas Vayigash. Vayomer avdecha avi eleinu. Yehuda is now quoting Yaakov. Atem yedatem kishnayim yodo li ishti. You know, this is Yaakov speaking through Yehuda, that my wife Rachel gave birth to two, V'yotso ha'echod me'iti v'omar af tarov tarav. V'lo risi laheno. And one of them has disappeared, and I believe he is dead. At that moment, says Rabbi Yehuda, Yosef says, now I understand. Why didn't my father come to look for me? Because he thought I was dead. And that is when, says Rav Ben Nun, Yosef is willing to reconcile with his brothers and to reconcile with his father, because until then he thought his father might have somehow been complicit in the unfolding of events. It's a revolutionary approach, certainly one that explains certain elements of Pshat. Finally, there's a third approach, and this is the one that I want to direct our attention to in a bit of a lengthier fashion. I will humbly admit that this is my approach. You can like it or not, I'll be happy to debate it with you towards the end of the session. I'd like to suggest that there's another message that emerges from the text, and I think it's an extremely important one. And it is based again upon the fact that we cannot look at these stories like fairy tales, but have to recognize the human complexity that really is embedded within them. I'd like to suggest that Yosef does not contact his father for one simple reason. Because he cannot. The truth is that if you look at the text carefully, the most dangerous time for Yosef in Egypt is when he becomes viceroy. Rather than assuming that suddenly everything is just beautiful and fine, the picture the Torah paints for us, if we look at the clues carefully, is a much more complex picture of a Yosef that has been suddenly propelled from anonymity to power, propelled over the heads, right, of Khartoumim and advisors and sergeants at arms. Suddenly now this Ivri is second in command. He is surrounded by people who certainly are jealous of his position and pine for it. And this is already a court of intrigue. This is already, how do we know that? How do we know this is a court of intrigue? Because of the butler and the baker in the dungeon. We already know that everybody is suspecting everybody else about the possibility of who knows? Who knows my who can I trust? Who can Yosef trust? Now, this position is based, as I said, upon textual evidence. Follow it with me, if you will. Turn to section 6. Section 6 is taken from the beginning of Parshas Miketz. Beginning of Parshas Miketz, Paro dreams his dreams. The Khartoumim attempt to interpret them. Yosef interprets them. Paro immediately accepts his interpretation. One question, by the way, which we will not explore today, which is a question for you to consider, is why does Paro believe Yosef? What is it? And the textual evidence is fascinating concerning that as well. But finally, after Yosef interprets the dream, Paro decides that this is the man he wants. This is the person he wants to. And the first thing he does, which is his father, says as follows. Vayita ha-domor ve'enei Paro uve'enei avodav. I'm now reading from the text that you don't have. This interpretation found favor in the eyes of Paro and his servants. Now the text you do have. Vayomer Paro el avodav. Hanimzo koze ish asher ruach elokim. Is there, have we found, or can we find anyone else who is invested with the Spirit of God? And then Paro says, Vayomer Paro el Yosef, Acharei hodia Elokim oscha es kol zos. After God has shown you all this, you're the best. Now my question to you is, the pasuk before you,
After Paro hears Yosef, one would expect the first thing he would do is turn to Yosef and say, that's wonderful, good interpretation. But the first thing he does is he speaks to the officers present and says, Hanimse kozeh ish asher ruach elokim bo. Why does he do that? Why does he first turn to his officers? He's very, very smart. Exactly. And he knows that this is a dangerous moment. In other words, I'm about to leapfrog this Eved Ivri over all your heads. Before I do it, anybody want to say something? Anybody got any better volunteers? Any of you can do what this guy can do? Speak up now. Their silence buys them and binds them to his decision. At that point, they can no longer come to him and say, you do this, you did this. He is now making them complicit in his actions. Do they ever fully accept this, however? Turn to the next section, and I want you to read what I think is one of the saddest psukim in the Torah. And it is, you have to understand the setting, and let me set it for you. It's Pasuk Lamed Bet and Perek Mem Gimel. I just want to find the setting. Right. This is the setting. The brothers have come. They've met Yosef. He has accused them of being monotonous, and he sent them back. Right? He sold them grain, but he did what? He took the money that they gave him, and he hid it in their bags. Why is he doing that? He's mind-gaming them. He's keeping them off balance. They now are afraid. They're afraid. We bought that grain. What's the money doing in our... We're going to go back. We're going to go back to see this man. And if we go back to see this man, he'll accuse us of being thieves. So they don't want to go back to Egypt. Finally, Yaakov convinces them they have to go back to Egypt. Yehuda convinces Yaakov that they must go back and bring Binyamin. They come back. They're afraid. What's the first thing Yosef does? Anyone remember as soon as they come back? Even before he releases Shimon, he wines and dines them, right? What basically happens is, right, as soon as they come back, they are met by one of his officers, they're frightened, they're trembling, he goes, hey, please come to the palace. They come to the palace and they have a feast and Shimon is released, etc. Exactly. All of this is to keep them off balance. But the Torah then describes the banquet. It's the first example of set seating in the Torah. Look at what it says, though. And it's, again, it's a very sad puzzle. Vayasimu lo levado, vilohem levado, vilamitzrim ha'ochlim ito levado. There are three sections, two matzvos. Yosef sits alone, the Mitzrim sit alone, and the Ivrim, the brothers sit alone. One, ki lo yuchmun ha-mitzrim lechol eso Ivrim lechem, ki to'eva ki le-mitzrayim. The Mitzrim won't eat with who? Not only they won't eat with the brothers, they won't eat with Yosef. He's an Ivri. We know that. They call him an Ivri. They refer to him as an Ivri. So Yosef, the viceroy of Egypt, doesn't have anybody to eat with. Now this is, as I say, one of the saddest psukim of the Torah, both because of what it says about our history in terms of our place in society throughout the ages, but also what it says vis-a-vis Yosef. Yosef is the ultimate outsider. Yosef is never accepted fully by any group within which he finds himself. In fact, Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal says that's why his leadership is not chosen. Yehuda is chosen for leadership because he rises from within. Yosef is the puppeteer. He stands outside and he manipulates events. Here you see that he is not accepted even by the Egyptians. Next evidence. Turn to section 8. Again, the setting is as follows. The setting is that Yosef finally reveals himself to the brothers. We moved along in the story. They have an emotional reunion. Creates a hubbub in the court. Something's happening. Yosef and his brothers have been reunited. And the Torah says twice, not once, V'hakol nishma beis paro, lomar bo ache Yosef, v'yitav be'enei paro uve'enei avodav. News reaches Paro that Yosef and his brothers have been reunited, and Paro is happy. What is it, a soap opera? Why is Paro happy? Why is Paro pleased that Yosef's brothers have come to Egypt? What? He's worried about his viceroy's happiness and emotional stability. What is this all about? And everybody, not just Paro, but the entire... So the Sfarno and the Ramban argue here. And they give different reasons. One reason suggested is that Yosef is, that Paro is happy because now they know that Yosef has Yichus. Well, you know what? He's not just Salman Ebedri. He's the son of a patriarch. Why is that important? Because he's been ruling over us. So now at least, it's not Stam and Eved that's been ruling over us. The second is even more devastating. Now his family will come here and he will no longer have dual loyalty. He won't be loyal to another country in another place. The common feature between these approaches and other approaches is suspicion of Yosef. Right? We're not fully trusting of this man. We don't know where he comes from. We don't know whether he really is an Egyptian. And therefore, anything that will cement his relationship to this land and to us and show us that he deserves to be who he is, that means until now, we haven't really been very happy about this. But the most obvious storyline in the Chumash that shows us Yosef's weakness and vulnerability in Egypt is the storyline that we read yesterday, Parshas Vayechi. It's a storyline that you know, but I want you to look at it even more carefully now. Yaakov turns to Yosef in Parshas Vayechi, in portion number 9. Vayikrahu Yimei Yisrael Lamos. Vayikra livno li Yosef, vayomer imno matzasi chen be'inecho, simno yodcha tachas yodechi, v'yosiso imadi chesed vel emes, al no tikr neini l'mitzrayim. Don't bury me in Egypt. Chesed v'yemes. V'shachavti malosai, and when I lie with my fathers, unisosani mimitzrayim ukvartani v'kifrosam, when I lie with my fathers, you will take me from Mitzrayim and bury me in their graves. Yosef says, Father, don't worry, it will be done. He shavali, promise me. And he makes him swear. Now, of course, we all ask the question, why does Yosef have to swear? Doesn't Yaakov trust him? We'll come back to it. Look at the next section. In the next section, Yaakov does something else. He's already bound Yosef to this agreement by a vow. But after he blesses his children, he turns to them as a group. And he repeats his desire to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. And look at his words, because they're very important. I'm
going to be buried. I'm going to die. Kivru osi elav osai elam or asher b'steyafron achiti. Bury me in the tomb of my fathers, in the cave that is in Ephron Achiti's Sadeh. B'ma'or asher b'steyam athpelo asher p'nei mamre b'eretz kenan asher kona avram esat sadam es Ephron. And he goes through the provenance of the field and he says, I want you to know he bought it, and I want you to know who bought it, and I want you to know how it happened. Shoma kavru etz Avram v'esora ishto. Shama kavru etz Yitzchak v'es Rivka ishto. And he goes, he's very, very specific, who is buried there, and he asks them to obligate themselves. It's not enough that Yosef is obligated, and there are those Mefarshim who say that he's afraid that Paro won't let Yosef go, so that's why he's talking to the brothers as well. Someone among you, make sure this is done. Fine. Now let's take a look at how this unfolds, how the request unfolds when Yosef approaches Paro. In our minds, Viceroy, King. Vayavru, section 11. Now look at it carefully. Yemei b'chiso, vayedaber Yosef el beis Paro lemor, im no matzot zichim be'inechem, dam hino b'yez bozne Paro lemor. Yosef approaches the house of Paro and says, please, I want you to approach the king with this request. So what's the first thing you see? Exactly. Second in command. Go into Paro. Say, I have a request. You know why? Because he's scared. Because he knows that this is an extremely dangerous request. Can you imagine? I'll go into Paro and I'll say to Paro, Paro, you know, we've had a wonderful time here, but my father doesn't want to be buried here. What? It's not good enough for him. We already know that Yaakov is an esteemed figure in Egypt. We know it from his meeting with Paro. We know this is an extremely dangerous request for Yosef. So he begins to play politics. He goes to the people around him and he says, look, you know, you want me, I'm just adding words, but scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, right? In other words, you want me, I'm powerful, I can help you, please go and bring this request to Paro. Now, but I want you to word the request carefully. And listen to it. Avi hishbi'ani lemor. Hinei anochi meis. My father made me swear. Behold, I am going to die. Bekivri asher korisi li be'eretz kenan shama tikvareni. Point. Finished. In the grave that I dug for myself in Eretz Kenan, there bury me. So what do you see from the way Yosef is wording this request? What's he done? He's done a number of things. First of all, he has, and this, say Chazal, is part of Yaakov's wisdom by making him swear. He's telling him how to do it. Do not talk to Paro about Oras HaMachpelo, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, V'shachavti, Mavosai. You don't want to mention any of that to the king. Right? That's not that. That will raise the king's ire. What do you mean? Not good enough. You want to go back there with them? We're your family now. We're your nation now. Says Yosef to the king through emissaries. It's a very simple thing. And it's something, by the way, Paro, that you will understand. Think of Egypt. Think of the respect for the dead. Think of obeying the wishes of those who are no longer there. It's a very simple thing. I am bound. My father made me swear. He purchased the plot. He dug the grave. It's not, as far as I'm concerned, it's another grave. But he dug that grave. He wants to be buried there. And he changes the entire thrust of the argument from an argument of I want to be with my legacy with to I am bound by the vow that my father made me take. I have no choice. I have no choice. And what does Paro respond? Look at Pasuk Vav. Vayomer Paro alei ukvar es avicha kaasher ishliyacho. Torah uses words very carefully. Says Paro, yep, that I understand. Kaasher ishliyacho, that I will accept, that I will respect. But then, it's fascinating. And notice also that Yosef, when he says to Paro, when he makes the request, he says, Ve'etpo es avi ve'ashuva. Because what's Paro's other fear? Paro's other fear is that as soon as he lets Yosef go, he isn't coming back. So Paro allows, but if you look in the text, and we're running a little close to the time, so I'll let you look at it yourself, you'll notice two things. That when Paro lets Yosef go to fulfill this vow, and lets the brothers go, he does two things. He sends an entire entourage with him. Right? This isn't just to show respect for Yaakov. This is to what? It's to make sure Yosef comes back. And the Torah is specific. He allows the brothers to go, but he makes them leave their families and their possessions in Egypt. Come back. Now why is this so important? I believe this is important because it shows us a very different picture than we learned in fourth grade. And unfortunately, what happens when it comes to Torah text is we lock ourselves into the picture we learned and we don't return as adults. When Yosef becomes viceroy in Egypt, he is in a very vulnerable position. I believe he could not contact his father. Think for a minute, who could he trust? Send somebody from the court out? That guy's going to turn around as soon as he gets outside of Yosef's sight and come back to Yosef and say, come back to Paro, or come back to one of the emissaries who's upset at Yosef's promotion and say to him, look, you know what? You know what Yosef's doing? He's communicating with outside forces. Send him one of his own children. Stopped at the border. Yosef is being watched, and Yosef understands that one. And it is this vulnerability, I believe, that stops him from communicating with his past. And it's only when that past comes to him that he is then able to eventually reunite with it. This picture explains a number of other things as well. It's fascinating that Yosef, who is the picture of the cosmopolitan Jew, right? That's who he is. He's the great American success story. Take Yosef, put him wherever you want, he always rises to the top. This same cosmopolitan Jew is the first person to orchestrate the first Jewish ghetto. Right? What does he do when his brothers and his family come down? Goshen. Tell Paro your shepherds, because he hates shepherds. He wants to keep. Yosef is aware of many things, of the price he's had to pay to get where he is. Perhaps he's afraid that not everyone in his family will be able to dance the same dance he did and retain the same. And perhaps he's aware of the sadness of his position, the vulnerability of the fact that he's alone in Egypt. And he wants them to keep together as a family. It is this picture of Yosef that is also historically a paradigm for us. It's an unfortunate and sobering paradigm. But it's a recognition that the Jew in Golos can rise to great heights, but that you're always... That's why Chazal, by the way, compared the Yosef story to the Purim story. they constantly make connections. Benafohu. And turn on a dime. And the recognition that as long as we remain in Galus, we are in that vulnerable position. And that only when we are home and rulers of our own destiny will we ever be able to, hopefully, please God, achieve that degree of comfort that we seek.
That also explains why you use the paradigm of the Rakam Hatem when challenging the brothers. So it's to kind of throw suspicion off himself as one of, as an outsider.
Well, I never thought of that, but it's a wonderful thought. As to, you know, because he knows that eventually they're going to be reunited, he doesn't want it also to be so simple, right? He accuses them, they have to go through a test, they have to go through whatever paces they have to go through, otherwise that he throws suspicion off of himself. It's very true. Alright, so what we're suggesting, just to review, is that there are a number of approaches to this question. The Ramban, the classical approach, we've reviewed Yoel Ben Nun's approach, which was revolutionary. This last approach, which I believe, I hope you find, is melded to the Pshat. I would end with one last thought to maybe not leave us in such a sobering point, because it's really very sad, right? We're saying that we're struggling. So one last thought, a little unrelated from the first pasuk of Parshas Vayechi. Pasuk says, "Vayechi Yaakov eretz Mitzrayim shvayas reishona." And this is an unusual pasuk, because rarely does the Torah simply tell us that kind of chronology. If you think about it, we always have to figure out how many years was Yaakov here, how many years was Avram here. Why is the Torah telling us? So Chazal say that the key is the word "vayechi." Vayechi means that. To, is not just to live, it means to live in comfort, to have a comfortable life. And they say these were the only 17 years of Yaakov's life where he was truly comfortable, where he wasn't struggling. Not struggling with Esau, not struggling with Laban, not with Shimon and Levi, not with Yosef being sold. Everybody's reunited. But along comes Rav Shimshon before the Hirsch. It's a beautiful thought. He says, yes, it's true that these are the only 17 years of comfort in Yosef's life, but they're also the only 17 years we know nothing about. He says, the productive years of Yaakov's life were the struggle. Adin Steinsatz, Rabbi Steinsatz says that the difference between the Jew and the world is the world pines for peace of mind. The Jew recognizes the value of the strife of the spirit. And that means that we're never, that it is when we are striving and when we're not that comfortable that we can achieve the greatest. So maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan for us is not to be so comfortable until we can find our way back home. Thank you very much.